Pushkin.
You can find inspiring stories almost anywhere. For instance, check out the co-founders of Girls Who Do Interiors. This Miami-based design company was started by three friends when they were still in school. And right from the start, they turned to Chase for Business for everything from banking and payment acceptance to credit cards. And they handled them all in one place with the Chase mobile app. It's so important to have that kind of help when you're just starting out. Learn more at chaseforbusiness.com. Make more of what's yours. Chase mobile app is available for select mobile devices. Message and data rates may apply. JPMorgan Chase Bank, N.A. member FDIC.
The most innovative companies are going further with T-Mobile for Business. The PGA of America is helping lower scores and elevate fan experiences with AI coaching tools and 5G-connected cameras. AAA is getting more drivers back on the road fast with location telematics. And the Las Vegas Grand Prix is powering race day operations with 5G connectivity, giving fans an experience at the speed they deserve. This is accelerating innovation with T-Mobile for Business. Take your business further at T-Mobile.com/now.
Musora is your access to online music lessons for guitar, piano, drums, and singing. You know, I love music, but I haven't picked up an instrument in years. You know why? I tell myself, I don't have time. Where am I going to find a teacher? Well, there's an answer. Musora. Musora is the place where you can learn essential skills and techniques with more than 100 of the world's best teachers and musicians and thousands of famous songs. You get 7 days totally free to try it out, and then it's just $30 per month, less than a single private lesson. Just go to musora.com, M-U-S-O-R-A.com, to start a new musical journey today.
If you feel like 5 out of 6 new books, movies, and TV shows are about how the world is ending, or they take place in a future where the world has just ended, then this essay is for you. It's about the history of dystopian fiction. And Jill Lepore spins an argument about the relationship between real-world political utopianism, disaffection, and our fictional dystopias.
So this piece was me trying to understand, like, you know, Hunger Games, Squid Games as a moment, as a response to the realization that, my God, you know, the internet didn't actually fix anything, and neither did Obama.
Here's the essay, No, We Cannot. Stick around after for a conversation with Jill about writing and reading dystopias.
No, We Cannot. Here are the plots of some dystopian novels set in the near future. The world got too hot, so a wealthy celebrity persuaded a small number of very rich people to move to a makeshift satellite that from orbit leeches the last nourishment the Earth has to give, leaving everyone else to starve. The people on the satellite have lost their genitals through some kind of instant mutation or super quick evolution, but there is a lot of sex anyway. Since it's become fashionable to have surgical procedures to give yourself a variety of appendages and openings, along with decorative skin grafts and tattoos, there being so little else to do. There are no children, but the celebrity who rules the satellite has been trying to create them by torturing women from the Earth's surface. We are what happens when the seemingly unthinkable celebrity rises to power, the novel's narrator says. Or North Korea deployed a brain-damaging chemical weapon that made everyone in the United States, or at least everyone in L.A., an idiot, except for a few people who were on a boat the day the scourge came, but the idiots, who are otherwise remarkably sweet, round up and kill those people out of fear. Led by a man known only as the Chief, the idiots build a wall around downtown to keep out the drifters and the stupidest people, the shamblers, who don't know how to tie shoes or button buttons. They wander around naked and barefoot. Thanks in part to the difficulty of clothing, there is a lot of sex, random and unsatisfying, but there are very few children because no one knows how to take care of them. The Jacket Copy bills this novel as the first book of the Trump era. Or
Machines replaced humans doing all the work and providing all the food. And even if you leave the city, it is hotter everywhere else, some huffy young people do, because they are bored. Not to mention, they are mad at their parents, who do annoying things like run giant corporations. The runaways are called walkaways. I gather they're not in a terribly big hurry. They talk about revolution, take a lot of baths, upload their brains onto computers, and have a lot of sex. But to be honest, they are very boring. Or, even after the coasts were lost to the floods when the ice caps melted, the American South, defying a new federal law, refused to give up fossil fuels and seceded, which led to a civil war, which has been going on for decades and was about to be over on Reunification Day, except that a woman from Louisiana who lost her whole family in the war went to the celebration and released a poison that killed 100 million people, which doesn't seem like the tragedy it might have been, because in this future world, as in all the others, there's not much to live for, what with the petty tyrants, the rotten weather, and the crappy sex. It will not give too much away if I say that none of these novels have a happy ending, though one has a twist. Then again, none of them have a happy beginning either. Dystopias follow utopias the way thunder follows lightning. Lately, the thunder is roaring. But people are so grumpy, what with the petty tyrants and such, that it's easy to forget how recently lightning struck. Whether we measure our progress in terms of wiredness, open-mindedness, or optimism, the country is moving in the right direction, and faster, perhaps, than even we would have believed, a reporter for Wired wrote in May of 2000. We are, as a nation, better educated, more tolerant, and more connected because of, not in spite of, the convergence of the internet and public life. Partisanship, religion, geography, race, gender, and other traditional political divisions are giving way to a new standard, wiredness, as an organizing principle. Nor was the utopianism merely technological or callow. In January 2008, Barack Obama gave a speech in New Hampshire about the American creed. It was a creed written into the founding documents that declared the destiny of a nation. Yes, we can. It was whispered by slaves and abolitionists as they blazed a trail toward freedom through the darkest of nights. Yes, we can. It was sung by immigrants as they struck out from distant shores and pioneers who pushed westward against an unforgiving wilderness. Yes, we can. Yes, we can heal this nation. Yes, we can repair the world. Yes, we can. That was the lightning, the flash of hope, the promise of perfectibility. The argument of dystopianism is that perfection comes at the cost of freedom. Every new lament about the end of the Republic, every column about the collapse of civilization, every new novel of doom, these are its answering thunder. Rumble, thud, rumble. Kaboom, kaboom. A utopia is a paradise. A dystopia, a paradise lost. Before utopias and dystopias became imagined futures, they were imagined pasts, or imagined places like the Garden of Eden. I have found a continent more densely peopled and abounding in animals than our Europe or Asia or Africa, and in addition, a climate milder and more delightful than any other region known to us, Amerigo Vespucci wrote in extravagant letters describing his voyages across the Atlantic, published in 1503 as Mundus Novus, a new world. In 1516, Thomas More published a fictional account of a sailor on one of Vespucci's ships who had traveled just a bit farther to the island of Utopia, where he found a perfect republic. More coined the term. Utopia means nowhere. Gulliver's Travels, 1726, is a satire of the utopianism of the Enlightenment. On the island of Laputa, Gulliver visits the Academy of Legato, where the sages, the first progressives, are busy trying to make pincushions out of marble, breeding naked sheep, and improving the language by getting rid of all the words. The word dystopia, meaning an unhappy country, was coined in the 1740s, as the historian Gregory Claes points out in a shrewd study, Dystopia, A Natural History. In its modern definition, a dystopia can be apocalyptic or post-apocalyptic or neither, but it has to be anti-utopian, a utopia turned upside down, a world in which people tried to build a republic of perfection, only to find that they had created a republic of misery. A Trip to the Island of Equality, a 1792 reply to Thomas Paine's Rights of Man, is a dystopia,
On the island, the pursuit of equality has reduced everyone to living in caves. But Mary Shelley's 1826 novel, The Last Man, is not dystopian. It's merely apocalyptic. The dystopian novel emerged in response to the first utopian novels, like Edward Bellamy's best-selling 1888 fantasy, Looking Backward, about a socialist utopia in the year 2000. Looking Backward was so successful that it produced a dozen anti-socialist, anti-utopian replies, including Looking Further Backward, in which China invades the United States, which has been weakened by its embrace of socialism, and Looking Further Forward, in which socialism is so unquestionable that a history professor who refutes it is demoted to the rank of janitor. In 1887, a year before Bellamy, the American writer Anna Bowman Dodd published The Republic of the Future, a socialist dystopia set in New York in 2050, in which women and men are equal, children are reared by the state, machines handle all the work, and most people, having nothing else to do, spend much of their time at the gym, obsessed with fitness. Dodd describes this world as the very acme of dreariness. What is a dystopia? The gym. That's still true. In a 2011 episode of Black Mirror, life on Earth in an energy-scarce future has been reduced to an interminable spin class. Utopians believe in progress, dystopians don't. They fight this argument out in competing visions of the future, utopians offering promises, dystopians issuing warnings. In 1895, in The Time Machine, H.G. Wells introduced the remarkably handy device of traveling through time by way of a clock. After that, time travel proved convenient, but even Wells didn't always use a machine. In When the Sleeper Awakes, 1899, his hero simply oversleeps his way into the 21st century, where he finds a world in which people are enslaved by propaganda and helpless in the hands of the demagogue. That's one problem with dystopian fiction. Forewarned is not always forearmed. Sleeping through the warning signs is another problem. I was asleep before, the heroine of The Handmaid's Tale says in the new Hulu production of Margaret Atwood's 1986 novel. That's how we let it happen. But what about when everyone's awake and there are plenty of warnings, but no one does anything about them? NK3 by Michael Tolkien is an intricate and cleverly constructed account of the aftermath of a North Korean chemical attack. The NK3 of the title has entirely destroyed its victims' memories and has vastly diminished their capacity to reason. This puts the novel's characters in the same position as the readers of all dystopian fiction. They're left to try to piece together not a whodunit, but a how did it happen. Seth Kaplan, who'd been a pediatric oncologist, pages through periodicals left in a seat back on a Singapore Airlines jet on the ground at LAX. The periodicals, like the plane, hadn't moved since the plague arrived. It confused Seth that the plague was front-page news in some, but not all, of the papers, Tolkien writes. They still printed reviews of movies and books, articles about new cars, ways to make inexpensive costumes for Halloween. Everyone had been awake, but they'd been busy shopping for cars and picking out movies and cutting eye holes in paper bags. The latest blighted crop of dystopian novels is pessimistic about technology, about the economy, about politics, and about the planet, making it a more abundant harvest of unhappiness than most other heydays of downheartedness. The internet did not stitch us all together. Economic growth has led to widening economic inequality and a looming environmental crisis. Democracy appears to be yielding to authoritarianism. Hopes dashed is, lately, a long list and getting longer. The plane is grounded, seat backs in the upright position, and we are dying slowly of stupidity. Pick your present-day dilemma. There's a new dystopian novel to match it. Worried about political polarization? In American War, Omar el-Akkad traces the United States' descent from gridlock to barbarism as the state of the former Confederacy, or at least the parts that aren't underwater, refuse to abide by the Sustainable Future Act and secede in 2074. Troubled by the new Jim Crow? Ben H. Winter's Underground Airlines is set in an early 21st century United States in which slavery abides, made crueler and more inescapable by the giant, unregulated slave-owning corporations that deploy their surveillance powers of modern technology, so that even escaping to the North on underground airlines hardly offers much hope, since free blacks in cities like Chicago live in segregated neighborhoods with no decent housing or schooling or work, and it's the very poverty in which they live that defeats arguments for abolition by hardening ideas about race. As the book's narrator, a fugitive slave, explains, black gets to mean poor and poor to mean dangerous, and all the words get murked together and become one dark idea, a cloud of smoke, the smokestack fumes drifting like filthy air across the rest of the nation. Radical pessimism is a dismal trend. The despair, this particular publishing season, comes in many forms, including the grotesque. In the Book of Joan, Lydia Yuknovich's narrator, Christine Pizan, is 49 and about to die, because she's living on a satellite orbiting the Earth where everyone is executed at the age of 50. The wet in their bodies constitutes the colony's water supply. Dystopia here is menopause. Her body has aged. If hormones have any meaning left for any of us, it is latent at best. She examines herself in the mirror. I have a slight rise where each breast began and a kind of mound where my pubic bone should be, but that's it. Nothing else of woman is left. Yuknovich's Pizan is a resurrection of the medieval French scholar and historian Christine de Pizan, who in 1405 wrote the allegorical Book of the City of Ladies and in 1429 the Song of Joan of Arc, an account of the life of the martyr. In the year 2049, Yuknovich's Pizan writes on her body by a torturous process of self-mutilation, the story of a 21st-century Joan who was trying to save the planet from Jean de Maine, another historical illusion, the insane celebrity who has become the ruler. In the end, de Maine himself is revealed to be not a man but what is left of a woman, with all the traces, sad, stitched-up sacks of flesh where breasts had once been, as if someone tried too hard to erase their existence, and a bulbous, sagging gash sutured over and over where life had perhaps happened in the past or not, and worse, several dangling attempts at half-formed penises, sewn and abandoned, distended and limp. Equal rights for women, emancipation, reconstruction, civil rights, so many hopes dashed, so many causes lost. Pizan pictured a city of women, Lincoln believed in union, King had a dream. Yuknovich and El Akkad and Winters unspool the reels of those dreams and recut them as nightmares. This move isn't new or daring. It is instead very old. The question is whether it's all used up, as parched as a post-apocalyptic desert, as barren as an old woman, as addled as an old man. A utopia is a planned society. Planned societies are often disastrous. That's why utopias contain their own dystopias. Most early 20th century dystopian novels took the form of political parables, critiques of planned societies, from both the left and the right. The utopianism of communists, eugenicists, New Dealers, and fascists produced the Russian novelist Yevgeny Zamyatin's We in 1924. Aldous Huxley's Brave New World in 1935, Ayn Rand's Anthem in 1937, and George Orwell's 1984 in 1949. After the war, after the death camps, after the bomb, dystopian fiction thrived, like a weed that favors shade. A decreasing percentage of the imaginary world are utopias, the literary scholar Chad Walsh observed in 1962. An increasing percentage are nightmares. Much in post-war pessimism had to do with the superficiality of mass culture in an age of affluence, and with the fear that the banality and conformity of consumer society had reduced people to robots. I drive my car to the supermarket, John Updike wrote in 1954. The way I take is super high, a super lot is where I park it, and super suds are what I buy. Super sudsy television boosterism is the utopianism attacked by Kurt Vonnegut in Player Piano, 1952, and by Ray Bradbury in Fahrenheit 451, 1953. Cold War dystopianism came in as many flavors as soda pop or superheroes, and in as many sizes as nuclear warheads. But in a deeper sense, the mid-century overtaking of utopianism by dystopianism marked the rise of modern conservatism, a rejection of the idea of the liberal state. Rand's Atlas Shrugged appeared in 1957 and climbed up the Times bestseller list. It has sold more than 8 million copies.
The second half of the 20th century, of course, also produced liberal-minded dystopias, chiefly concerned with issuing warnings about pollution and climate change, nuclear weapons and corporate monopolies, technological totalitarianism, and the fragility of rights secured from the state. There were, for instance, feminist dystopias. The utopianism of the moral majority, founded in 1979, lies behind The Handmaid's Tale, a book that is, among other things, an updating of Harriet Jacobs' 1861 Incidents in the Life of a Slave Girl. But rights-based dystopianism also led to the creation of a subgenre of dystopian fiction, bleak futures for Bobby Soxers. Dystopianism turns out to have a natural affinity with American adolescents, and this, I think, is where the life of the genre got squeezed out like a beetle burned up on an asphalt driveway by a boy wielding a magnifying glass on a sunny day. It sizzles, and then it smokes, and then it just lies there, dead as a bug. Dystopias featuring teenage characters have been a staple of high school life since The Lord of the Flies first came out in 1954. But the genre only really took off in the aftermath of Vietnam and Watergate, when distrust of adult institutions and adult authority flourished, and the publishing industry began producing fiction packaged for young adults aged 12 to 18. Some of these books are pretty good. M.T. Anderson's 2002 YA novel, Feed, is a smart and fierce answer to the Don't Be Evil utopianism of Google, founded in 1996. All of them are characterized by a withering contempt for adults and by an unshakable suspicion of authority. The Hunger Games, whose first installment appeared in 2008, has to do with economic inequality, but like all YA dystopian fiction, it's also addressed to readers who feel betrayed by a world that looked so much better to them when they were just a bit younger. I grew up a little, and I gradually began to figure out that pretty much everyone had been lying to me about pretty much everything, the high school age narrator writes at the beginning of Ernest Cline's best-selling 2011 YA novel, Ready Player One. Lately, even dystopian fiction marketed to adults has an adolescent sensibility, pouty and hostile. Cory Doctorow's novel, Walkaway, begins late at night at a party in a derelict factory with a main character named Hubert. At 27, he had 7 years on the next oldest partier. The story goes on in this way, with Doctorow inviting grown-up readers to hang out with adolescents, looking for immortality, while supplying neologisms like spum instead of spam to remind us that we're in a world that's close to our own, but weird. My father spies on me, the novel's young heroine complains. Walkaway comes with an endorsement from Edward Snowden. Doctorow's earlier novel, a YA book called Little Brother, told the story of four teenagers and their fight for internet privacy rights. With Walkaway, Doctorow pounds the same nails with the same bludgeon. His Walkaways are trying to turn a dystopia into a utopia by writing better computer code than their enemies. A pod of mercs and an infotech goon pwned everything using some zero-day they'd bought from scumbag default Infowar researchers, is the sort of thing they say. They took over the drone fleet, and while we dewormed it, it seized the mechas. Every dystopia is a history of the future. What are the consequences of a literature, even a pulp literature, of political desperation? It's a sad commentary on our age that we find dystopias a lot easier to believe in than utopias, Atwood wrote in the 1980s. Utopias we can only imagine, dystopias we've already had. But what was really happening then was that the genre and its readers were sorting themselves out by political preference, following the same path to the same ideological bunkers as families, friends, neighborhoods, and the news. In the first year of Obama's presidency, Americans bought 500,000 copies of Atlas Shrugged. In the first month of the administration of Donald American Carnage Trump, during which Kellyanne Conway talked about alternative facts, 1984 jumped to the top of the Amazon bestseller list. Steve Bannon is a particular fan of the 1973 French novel called The Camp of the Saints, in which Europe is overrun by dark-skinned immigrants. The duel of dystopias is nothing so much as yet another place poisoned by polarized politics, a proxy war of imaginary worlds. Dystopia used to be a fiction of resistance. It's become a fiction of submission, the fiction of an untrusting, lonely, and sullen 21st century, the fiction of fake news and info wars, the fiction of helplessness and hopelessness. It cannot imagine a better future, and it doesn't ask anyone to bother to make one. It nurses grievances and indulges resentments,
It doesn't call for courage. It finds that cowardice suffices. Its only admonition is, despair more. It appeals to both the left and the right because in the end it requires so little by way of literary, political, or moral imagination, asking only that you enjoy the company of people whose fear of the future aligns comfortably with your own. Left or right, the radical pessimism of an unremitting dystopianism has itself contributed to the unraveling of the liberal state and the weakening of a commitment to political pluralism. This isn't a story about war, Ella Codd writes in American War. It's about ruin. A story about ruin can be beautiful. Wreckage is romantic. But a politics of ruin is doomed. 2017.
You can find inspiring stories almost anywhere. For instance, check out the co-founders of Girls Who Do Interiors. This Miami-based design company was started by three friends when they were still in school. And right from the start, they turned to Chase for Business for everything from banking and payment acceptance to credit cards. And they handled them all in one place with the Chase mobile app. It's so important to have that kind of help when you're just starting out. Learn more at chaseforbusiness.com. Make more of what's yours. Chase mobile app is available for select mobile devices. Message and data rates may apply. JPMorgan Chase Bank, N.A. member FDIC.
The most innovative companies are going further with T-Mobile for Business. The PGA of America is helping lower scores and elevate fan experiences with AI coaching tools and 5G-connected cameras. AAA is getting more drivers back on the road fast with location telematics. And the Las Vegas Grand Prix is powering race day operations with 5G connectivity, giving fans an experience at the speed they deserve. This is accelerating innovation with T-Mobile for Business. Take your business further at T-Mobile.com/now.
See new things. Try new things. Go back centuries while living in the moment. Forge new paths while discovering old ones. Pedal, paddle, and paint while trekking, tasting, and tailoring experiences that transform you into a better version of yourself. Immerse yourself in the world by activating your mind, your heart, and your body on a river cruise exclusively from Avalon Waterways. Save with limited time offers at avalonwaterways.com. Avalon is cruising. Elevated.
One of the things I found interesting about this essay is the I mean, obviously the title is a reference to Yes, We Can.
Mm-hmm.
And
si, like, si puede.
I thought of the, yeah, like everything's been dystopia for the last, I don't know, decade or half decade, whatever it is, almost a decade. And it had never occurred to me to think of that as not a reflection of all the problems in the world, but rather a feeling of loss about what had seemed to be a utopian moment in American life.
Mm-hmm.
Is that actually how you understand the rise of dystopias or this sort of dueling dystopia world?
Yeah, I mean, I read a lot of stuff about the history of the idea of a utopia and then the origins of what people call dystopian fiction, you know, which really goes back to Mary Shelley, not so much to Frankenstein, because it's not apocalyptic, but to The Last Man, which is the only other novel she published, which is about the global pandemic in which everybody dies, but The Last Man. And I had gotten really interested in the notion that every cultural phase of dystopianism, where like the prevailing mood is dystopian, followed a phase of really quite great hopefulness and even of significant kind of social or political engineering or economic engineering that we would associate with utopianism. I mean, the idea of a utopia has to be kind of a planned utopia. You don't like stumble across a utopia. Like the Garden of Eden is not a utopia in that sense. Like a utopia is something you create. And that's what, you know, Gulliver's Travels all kind of making fun of, the idea of the created, perfected world. So, like, Enlightenment thinking is utopian. Our Constitution is utopian. Like, it imagines that you could fix like if all humans are fallen, all men are fallen, what if there's original sin, or, you know, you have to kind of begin with Calvinism, but then you could engineer your, you know, in this Panglossian way, engineer your way to a perfect world, or the Bentham utilitarianism, right? But then, like, that never works. So it's always going to be followed by, I guess actually there's still the evil found a way through the great perfect machine that we built, and it's spilling all over the place. And it turns out you can never really fix anything. So I think I thought that was really interesting as a matter of like literary interpretation. And you can, it doesn't run through all literature. It's really kind of a genre fiction thing. But if, you know, the dystopianism of the sort of H.G. Wells, the sort of socialist, anti-colonialist science fiction writers of the end of the 19th century, beginning of the 20th century, they're understanding that both whatever was predicted as utopian about capitalism or socialism, both of those things are failing. So their critique of those engineered worlds is going to be, let's work this through. What's going to happen next? All the evil's going to leak out of the perfect machine that we're building. And so I don't even remember how this assignment started. I think I was asked to just like read a roundup of a bunch of new works of science fiction, and they were all dystopian. And so I was like, well, I guess I have to understand the origins of like Hannah Arendt writes the origins of totalitarianism and I write the origins of dystopianism. It's like, that's not super helpful. I'm not fighting the Nazis.
Fighting despair, though.
But it's basically a critique of progressivism, right? Because it's the idea of progress that underlies all utopianism, the idea of perfectibility. So, you know, you have all these like science fiction dystopians, and then the progressives are like, no, but bureaucracy will fix it. Like, okay, maybe socialism didn't work. Maybe capitalism unchecked doesn't work. But we have these new regulations and agencies and bureaus, and we have bureaucracy. We'll fix it. And then there's another wave of, you know, the kind of 50s science fiction about conformism. And it's basically kind of administrative state, deep state, conspiracy theory stuff comes out of that, right? So it does make sense as a kind of warp and woof or whatever pattern that is. So this piece was me trying to understand, like, you know, Hunger Games, Squid Games as a moment, as a response to the realization that, like, you know, the internet didn't actually fix anything, and neither did Obama. Like, that was like, oh, shoot. So I guess the evil just leaks out. Like, no matter what machine we build, the evil is just going to leak out. It's going to be all over the floor, like blood on a carpet. And the thing that I ended up feeling kind of badly about writing about in this piece, though, now that I'm remembering it, was how juvenile that seems as a reaction. Like, it's just so black and white. In the kind of way that like the cognition of a teenager or someone in their late teens and even in their early 20s often is like, oh, well, if everything's not going to be great the way I thought it was going to be great, then it all sucks. and then you also see that the real marketing success of the dystopian science fiction and genre fiction is in YA books, mm-hmm. You know, like that Hunger Games world really is like that moment when, as a teenager, like having, if you had a happy childhood and as a little kid, it's like, everything's great. Like, my parents really love me and I get to, you know, play basketball in my neighborhood and my grandma brings me cookies on Sunday and whatever it is that, like, your child, if you have like a very happy, secure childhood and then you get to be a teenager and it's like, Santa Claus isn't real and my dad's actually an asshole. And like, suddenly everything goes from being bright to being very dark. And then someone hands you the Hunger Games. And it's like, you know what? The big secret is all the adults suck. And that's what that dystopian alt move is, kind of, in a way. And I will say, like, as a parent of three teenage boys at the time I was writing this, I was like, you know what? Someone has to say, like, it's not just black and white. And that's like the problem with, that is a big problem with that kind of fiction. Or with those kind of oscillating, you know, the same country that elected Barack Obama elected Donald Trump and may well elect him again. And you have to puzzle your way through that and find a way. However, you know, if to you it's the same country that elected Donald Trump, made the great mistake of electing Barack Obama, fine. But you still have to puzzle your way through that. You can't pretend that one of the elections was illegitimate and one was fixing everything and making America great and the other was fucking everything up. Like, you have to just accept that even our polities, like, our politics is not like all of each. Like, you know, it doesn't... When these people are winning elections by tens of thousands of votes, it's the same country. Like, you, so that's why I ended up with the "No, we cannot," because the, at some level, the juvenile quality of reacting to Trump's election by saying, "Well, then the whole country sucks." Like, there's a kind of, it's all over. Like, there is no future. Yeah. That drives me a little nuts.
There is something, though, you point out in the piece that utopia means nowhere and dystopia means an unhappy country. So it does feel like it's kind of baked into the premise of one of these
things is real,
like from the beginning.
Yeah. Well, I think that also people don't have, and as a young person, especially in the YA kind of world, you have to figure out where your worldview is. Like, do you believe in the fall of man? Do you know what I mean? Like that's why you read books. Like, you have to deduce that from your experience of the world and in your own reading. And it is really useful to go read Mary Shelley's Last Man or go read Frankenstein or go read Dickens or go read James Baldwin, whatever you want to read. Like, you're going to piece together an understanding of humankind and the natural world and life after death, or, you know, you may inherit a worldview that's religious from your religious upbringing, and you may not inherit a worldview in exactly that way, or you may struggle with the weird secular commercial view you got growing up on YouTube, but you still have to have a view, and to allow it to be defined by the mood of pessimism in our politics, I don't know. That's pretty crummy. Like, then you really don't have it. Like, everything looks bad in our politics. So, I don't know. I just, the books for grown-ups that are just kind of cheap dystopianism did kind of piss me off. I'm not, maybe that probably comes through.
Yeah.
I was probably a little bit. I was a little mean about some of those books, probably.
Is there a dystopia that you like? Was there something from this most recent batch of dystopias that you liked? Or did you turn to any during the pandemic?
No,
this is pre-pandemic.
I would say, like, when I was a young person, just to be, like, candid, like, when I read The Handmaid's Tale, it had a huge effect on me. I mean, partly I was living in Cambridge, where it is set, so you knew all the sites were recognizable. You know, and I was, like, you know, volunteering at the Women's Center or whatever and hanging out at the feminist bookstore. And it really meant something to me, and I think it is a genuinely revelatory way of imagining the dystopia that falls from a certain kind of confidence about what feminism accomplished and did not accomplish at that moment in time. I love that book, and I get what that, it actually helped me to think and sharpen my own ideas about how power operates in society. It didn't leave me feeling like, oh my God, there's nothing worth fighting for. It felt to me like a really useful cautionary tale. I think it's kind of a brilliant, brilliant, brilliant book. I think she's Atwood has written many really amazing pieces of fiction, but I love that. I love that book, and it really, I read it at exactly the right moment. I was at the age when that kind of dystopianism can be especially powerful. So yeah, I don't like object to it all told. I think what I haven't myself come across is the sort of dystopianism or critically minded novel about tech utopianism that is helpful in that way, right? I think ultimately most of that sort of Cory Doctorow and Cory Doctorow adjacent kind of stuff really participates in the kind of tech guys as gods, even if it disagrees or wants to kind of call our attention to possible ill effects of loss of privacy or, you know, whatever. Even they want to paint a dystopia, but it's actually kind of, it's quite disempowering. There's an Isaac Asimov story from 1955 called Franchise, in which computers have gotten so good at predicting elections and figuring out a representative sample of the population in order to predict elections that it's not really worth having elections anymore. So every presidential election year, one person casts a vote, and that person has been chosen by the supercomputer as the most representative American at that moment in time. And then that person bears basically the burden of the presidency because it was that person's choice. And like, I love that kind of a tech science fiction endeavor that actually kind of calls attention to the sort of logical consequence of a way that a technology is moving and a kind of human capitulation to it is moving. I just don't know that I've seen that about our moment that felt to me the way like Handmaid's Tale felt to me when I read it about that moment. So I would love to see that. Like, I'm a huge science fiction fan. Like, I love the genre, but I don't really love dystopianism unless it's helping me.
At JCPenney, fashion counts for everybody and every body. The weather is getting warmer, and it's time to swap my winter layers for fun, vibrant, and cool clothing. With so many fun things happening this spring, like Mother's Day and the Wind Down Tour, it's hard to find great-looking clothes that fit you just right. That's why I love JCPenney. JCPenney has so many stylish and comfortable options for so many different body types. I've been blown away by their selection, and everything hugs my body in all the right spots. Refresh your wardrobe this spring with style that gets you. Something to wear that fits your favorite moments of the season at prices that feel just as good. Discover brands that get you and put style and comfort first, like Worthington and Liz Claiborne for her, each in women's petite and plus sizes. Here, spring comes in all shapes, sizes, and colors. JCPenney, make everybody count.
This episode brought to you by 20th Century Studios' Kingdom of the Planet of the Apes. Director Wes Ball breathes new life into the epic franchise. As a ruthless king attempts to build his empire at the expense of the remaining human race, a young ape begins a journey to fight for a future for apes and humans alike. Kingdom of the Planet of the Apes. Enter the kingdom in IMAX on May 10th and theaters everywhere. Get tickets now.
Musora is your access to online music lessons for guitar, piano, drums, and singing. You know, I love music, but I haven't picked up an instrument in years. You know why? I tell myself I don't have time. Where am I going to find a teacher? Well, there's an answer. Musora. Musora is the place where you can learn essential skills and techniques with more than 100 of the world's best teachers and musicians and thousands of famous songs. You get 7 days totally free to try it out. And then it's just $30 per month, less than a single private lesson. Just go to musora.com, M-U-S-O-R-A.com, to start a new musical journey today.